Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the A10 Talk podcast. Sam Basil joined alongside Kaylee Godek, Daniel Frank, and Isaac Harris. And friends, last time we were on this podcast, we were talking about Rhodey basketball. And one of the tips that we gave Rhodey was pretty simple. It was after their St. Bonaventure loss. In their next game against Dayton, you know, the one thing that they can do to kind of impress us is not let up 99 points like they did against St. Bonaventure. They did not let up 99 points against Dayton that weekend, but they let up 96 for their second consecutive loss. And then on Wednesday, they followed it up with another loss at home to the Fordham Rams, 71-68, in a really close back and forth game all throughout. Rhode Island is kind of, I'm looking at their record right now, and I'm looking how they, you know, they've gotten to their record. 3-3 in the Atlantic 10, 9-10 overall. Just a really streaky team. They're on a 3-game losing streak, and that was preceded by a 4-game winning streak, which was preceded by a 5-game losing streak. Rhode Island already showing some cracks, or is this just you know, just another weird start to the Atlantic 10 season?
That's just Rhodey in a nutshell on the men's side right now. Not trying to bash Rhodey at all, but just with the two teams that are local to me, one of them being UMass, the other one being Rhodey, just with how I've watched Rhodey, like, it just seems like there is just hot streaks of winning and losing. Once they lose one big, it seems like it takes them like 2 to 3 or maybe even 4 games to get out of it. I think they just need to figure out a way of getting out of it, and hopefully they can possibly do that this weekend, but it just all really depends on who they're playing and who, like, who really comes to play mentally, physically, and emotionally. I feel like that's the main factors for this Rhodey team. They obviously came to play against my UMass team. Still have not watched that game. I've chosen not to because I feel like I would be screaming at that too much after I missed it. But honestly, I feel like if Rhodey just can find a way to win this weekend, I feel like they would be in a good boat, especially as they're going up against George Mason, which we'll talk a little bit more about later on the podcast.
And, you know, one stat that kind of stuck out to me, especially when it comes to Fordham, because Fordham right now is a team where if you look at their splits, turnover margin has been a huge factor in a lot of Fordham games. And it was clearly a factor here against Rhode Island. If you look right now, Fordham committed 6 turnovers in that game. Rhode Island committed 14, allowing Fordham to score 15 points off those Rhodey turnovers. Daniel or Isaac, any major thoughts on how this game went down? Anything that really stuck out to you, or was the turnover battle pretty much kind of what sunk it for the Rhodey Rams?
Yeah, Rhodey's weird. I mean, they. I feel like the issue with them has been, since RG Miller took over, has just been lacking consistency from one game to the next. They've shown flashes. They've shown really nice flashes this year in particular. But since Archie's been at Rhode Island, I haven't felt like we've had a consistent streak of Rhode Island showing potential from one game to the next. And I feel like that was kind of what you saw a little bit against Fordham. Is Fordham came in, was a little physical. They weren't super, they never looked fully comfortable to me. It just never felt like they were in the game. I'm curious what you think, Isaac.
No, you took the words right out of my mouth, Daniel. Rhode Island just hasn't shown that they've been consistent. Like, they've always been a darling of the A-10. Even when Archie took the job, it's like, oh, Archie can rebuild this pretty quick. Rhode Island's always had a great way to find good players or develop great teams. But right now, just showing if and are, it's on and off with them. And one thing is just finding consistency. Now, are they going to find that consistency this weekend? I'm not sure, because they're playing against another somewhat like very hot, streaky, sometimes inconsistent team as well. So it's like, I think you're good as your next possession. So you got to see who gets the last possession with that. So hopefully Rhodey can find their balance or where they need to be.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it's not Saturday.
I mean, it's not Saturday, but that's something. It's yeah. I hope it's not Saturday, but it's weird to see.
Yeah, speaking of streaky, Mason also, they broke a 3-game losing streak with a win against St. Bonaventure last week. But before that, that was a 3-game losing streak that was broken with a 69-60 win over St. Bonaventure. And that losing streak broke a 6-game winning streak that, you know, extends all the way back into non-conference play. So again, yeah, it's just, again, like we've seen so many years in the Atlantic 10, it's about momentum, it's about being streaky at the right time, at the wrong time, and that could really, set the tone for where you end up in the Atlantic 10. That Fordham game, that Fordham Rhode Island game was just one of a few really interesting games so far in the weekday slate of Atlantic 10 play. Obviously, on Tuesday night, we've got a couple other interesting ones. Dayton beating LaSalle in a pretty decisive manner, but also a pretty low-scoring affair for what we've seen from Dayton recently. A 66 to 54 win for the Flyers there. Duquesne taking down St. Bonaventure for their first conference win of the year, 54 to 50. And then finally, or not finally, but most importantly, that we want to talk about the St. Joseph's game where they took down UMass at the buzzer, 78-77 in Amherst. Eric Reynolds had 31 points and 3 steals for the Hawks. A lot of buzz for him this week after that game, including if you look, I believe this was posted on St. Joe's men's basketball official page. There it's just a little compilation of people talking about Eric Reynolds, and our very own KG was featured in that little in a couple snippets there. That was in the press conference, right? The post game.
Yeah, so that was actually in our post-game presser with Billy Lang, and I actually what I do with all of our conference play games now is I actually request all for the away team coaches. So I've requested for Fran Dunphy, I've requested for Keith Dambrot, Chris Caputo, as well as now Billy Lang. And funny enough, I literally said, like, I always say, "Hey, coach, how are you?" to start off whenever I have one of the opposing coaches come in. And he looks at me and says, "That's the first time anyone's ever asked me, how are you after a game, especially a game like this." And honestly, the fact that my question ended up like as the opening clip of that was actually pretty cool. And let's just say I may have gone St. Joe's Twitter famous. Honestly, that game on Tuesday drove me insane. And honestly, the St. Joe's presence was there. Like, there were a whole bunch of St. Joe's fans. And from where we had press row on Tuesday night, you could hear those St. Joe's fans as they are right, like, surrounded right around us.
Yeah, so that game ended on a Lynn Greer layup to seal the win for St. Joe's, but obviously, there were cracks showing throughout that game. What do you think allowed St. Joe's to put themselves in that position to get the win against UMass?
Well, to start off, St. Joe's got held scoreless several times throughout both the first half and the start of the second half. And halfway through that second half, they found themselves in the hole down by 13. Well, fast forward to the under four timeout. Basically, the game's a tie game almost. They erase that deficit and change it into only being by a couple of points. And well, let's just say it was a tale of two stories. UMass did not hit their season high of turnovers. They had 17 turnovers, their highest amount of turnovers on the seasons against South Florida, but with 18. But turnovers definitely hurt the Minutemen, as well as they missed, I believe it was only like three free throw shots or four, I forget the exact number. But the fact that they missed free throws throughout the game, if they hadn't missed those free throws and they made like a few threes or another basket here or there, definitely would have helped UMass in their favor. But honestly, there was no way of stopping Eric Reynolds, especially in front of NBA scouts from both the Celtics and the Spurs. Those scouts were asking questions about both sides of St. Joe's and UMass, especially since they saw that there was someone at the game covering the Atlantic 10. So they kind of just threw a whole bunch of questions at me from both sides about like both teams essentially. And basically, Eric Reynolds chose the right night to have a night. And well, one of the scouts called it at halftime, "Oh, Eric Reynolds is dropping at least 30." He dropped 31. So the fact that the scout called it kind of was impressive, but no, it was pretty sad. But Rasul Diggins, at least against Philly schools, has always been scoring in double digits when we play in conference. So 17 points for him on the night after having a career high of 25 against GW. So the fact that Diggins was able to carry that over was pretty good, but honestly, the fact that Lynn Grier III scored that game-winning layup.
So Reynolds, a really great night in front of the scouts. Sometimes for a guy like that, especially in mid-major basketball, that's all it really takes, right? One good night, kind of carry you into a good conference, a good rest of conference play, have some more people, taking a look at you throughout, their home schedule into the Atlantic 10 tournament when they head down to Brooklyn. And that's kind of what I wanted to get into for our next topic is kind of getting an early look, or maybe not an early look, but a mid-season look into some potential NBA talk here with some of these guys. I feel like the obvious choice for an NBA draft prospect in the Atlantic 10 is Daron Holmes. I feel like every time Dayton is on a nationally televised game, it feels like a lot of the announcers repeat this same story about how Daron Holmes is. He's draft ready. He might have been draft ready last year, but just the way things were falling, just in the league, with other guys coming up in the draft, apparently he was told that other people that it might be best to stick around in college one more year, continue to build your skills, continue to be flashy like he has been for Dayton so far. So he's clearly a front runner for being a draft pick in this year's NBA draft, or even getting a two-way contract, something like that. But what I wanted to ask all of you is, who is that number two person? Who do you think could kind of emerge as not necessarily like a high draft pick, a lottery pick, but maybe a late second rounder, a two-way contract kind of guy? Do you see Eric Reynolds being that? What would his skill set be like in the NBA? What would a team be looking for that they would want to pick him up? And is there anybody else that's kind of that you feel like on your plate that you feel like could get some looks?
I mean, you hit Eric Reynolds right on the nail. I know there were questions some, that I got from the scouts about several UMass players, one of them being some questions about being Cross and his return. Cross did play in that game on Tuesday. I know I didn't mention that, but also, like, another person I would be thinking besides Holmes and Reynolds could be Cross, but I think Cross wants to stay one more year at least at UMass and use up that year, last year of eligibility, and just get even stronger because he's improved so much from last year. But that could be a sneaky one towards the end, not even like to like the fact of like being a late second round, but being like almost like one of the last picks in the NBA draft period. But I don't know.
I'm gonna throw a name in that's maybe a little off the wall, but it's always struck me that he might get a look, and that's Joe Bamizel, of VCU. I came to know him when he was at GW, not personally, but just his game, and he always had flashes of just like the guy, type of guy that could maybe not be an NBA mainstay, but the type of dude that would like on a random Tuesday in February probably have like a 40-point game for like the last place team in the NBA and like would get like a week of Twitter buzz and then disappear into oblivion. But like I feel like Joe, like yeah, he's not gonna become Steph Curry, obviously. He's not gonna be like ever in a starting lineup probably. But I feel like he has the ability to contribute to an NBA roster with some bench scoring or something. I mean, he's certainly taken on that role this year with VCU. With the weird way that his eligibility went down and whatnot, I don't believe he started a single game still for VCU. I think he's come off the bench in each of his nine appearances. And that was not what he was doing at GW. I mean, when he was at GW, he was starting 29 or 30 games for GW. And then took a year at Oklahoma. Really didn't get much playing time there. Same way at Virginia Tech, he didn't get a lot of playing time. But I could see Joe Bamizel getting a look.
Do you feel like he's kind of a hard player to scout,
Oh,
considering the
yeah.
fact that he's been at four different programs in 4 years? He's played a varying amount of games for those programs. Like you said, he started 29 out of 30 games for GW. Out of the three other schools that he's been at so far, he has not started a game at any of those other schools.
Yeah. I mean, he's weird because if you want to go even further back, he went to four different high schools in 4 years. So this is a kid that's been at eight schools in 8 years. I mean, he's got like such a unique game. The thing that to me that always struck me is he has such an interesting release on his shot. I feel like he has he gets a lot of height on his jump shot, but then he has such a quick release. Because I feel like that makes him unique to scout as well from that perspective. He's just such an interesting case in terms of the playing time he gets and the looks he gets for, playing for two Power Fives and two A-10 schools. And in a weird way too, I can't help but wonder if his whole saga in the offseason leading into the season of, let Joe Bamizzo play this season, did it help him in any way, shape, or form, which is his name was certainly all around Twitter. You never know what helps the guy. Just get your name out there. All press is good press, they say. Maybe that helps him.
Yeah. And do you feel like that return? Because I feel like people talk about this a lot when it comes to transferring between a mid-major or a Power Five, Power Six, whatever you want. It's a matter of if your main focus is getting to the NBA, right? Sometimes guys, they don't want to take that step up because they're just not going to get the playing time. They're gonna go from a starter like Bamisil was to a bench player, a role player. Or guys, I think a good example, Khalid Moore on Fordham, right? He didn't really start a lot of games at Georgia Tech, but then he came to Fordham and he was the guy. So do you feel like there's something about that enticed Bamisil to come back to the Atlantic 10? I know he hasn't started a game this season, but do you think that's been a big factor in his return to the Atlantic 10? And do you think that's going to be something that schools in the A10 and in other mid-major conferences will want to use, going forward?
It's an interesting point you bring up. I mean, certainly we've seen on the women's side, there's been a ton of intra-conference transfers. I mean, Emma Squire is going to Rhode Island. Kenna Magasa going from Dayton to Rhode Island. I mean, there's a number of examples on the women's side you've seen of this with, players going to different schools within the A10. Players coming back to the conference after leaving is an interesting point you bring up because certainly especially since the NCAA seems to be leaning towards the direction of allowing multi-time transfers to have immediate eligibility, within the next couple of years, that seems like that's coming. It's an interesting thing because a lot of these players, I think, when they try to transfer up, some of them make it. And then you have a guy like Max Avesmith, who was like the guy at Oral Roberts and puts up decent numbers, but I don't feel like he has the same star power that he had when he was at Oral Roberts. Now that he's playing at a Power Five. And so you may well see guys come back. And certainly Joe has shown that this is a level he can perform at. And when he was at GW, I mean, I always think of the Maryland game. He was like lighting it up. I don't remember how many points he put up, but he was hitting a bunch of threes, getting into it with the Maryland student section on the road. Like he lives to be that type of villain energy. The A-10's clearly a level he's shown he can compete at. So, who knows what happens?
Another name I just want to throw in a hat that I just thought about actually, James Bishop. James Bishop has been in the running for Player of the Year, from last season to even now this season, has been able to put up big games when it's needed. But he can also get a little streaky sometimes, like when he only put up 8 points against UMass this past weekend against, again, UMass went 2 for 14 from the field, and then that's all he got in the entire game, and all 8 of his points came in the first half. So there's times where he can get really streaky. There's times where, well, he's just able to like shoot lights out and, well, carry this revolutionary team. So you never know.
Yeah, I'd be remiss too if I didn't throw out Keyshawn Hall as well. I know Isaac can speak about Keyshawn a little bit, but he certainly in the non-conference play I know showed some flashes as well.
Yeah, no, and just to add to all that, just with Keyshawn's about the reason why he's getting all the NBA looks, because not about just his stats alone, it's the potential. Being around a lot of other NBA scouts and what they look for and how they scout is potential. Like, how can you develop this guy? Or does he already have it already there? So, like, in regards to the conversations, when you look at James Bishop, you look at James Bishop saying, like, oh, he's a mature guard. He's been at one place majority of his career. He's a little older. He could probably adjust to the pro style game better as a guard, be a serviceable vet, almost like a, not saying like in player comparison, like a Jaime Jaquez, but in a good situation where there's a good foundation, You want an older guy that can just adjust, understand, and kind of just adapt easily. Joe has that same potential. Older guy, despite the transfers, they look at all the potential. But with Keyshawn, it's like, oh, he has all the tangibles. He has the height. He has the body. He has the positioning of a 3-and-D guy. With the right, if in the right organization, you can develop him into a prototypical NBA wing. So Keyshawn, it's not a, like, Keyshawn has great stats, 3 out of 8, 10, but a lot of the NBA scouts are looking at like, oh, there's a lot of potential. There's just with his just body of work on what he looks like, there's just potential there as it is. The stats just help. But majority with a lot of the A-10 guys, unless you're like Obi Toppin, that are just like, just flowing through the potential and through the stats, a lot of the guys we won't really see until toward later half to the official second half of the season, getting closer toward the A-10 tournament. The A-10 tournament is when we're going to really, really see the scouts really look at like, all right, it's gut check time. What are the guys going to show me? Because it going into the tournament, going to the NCAA tournament, going to any postseason tournament, it's where you really want to showcase what you have. So they could be quiet the whole throughout the year, but or if they get quiet toward playoffs when it really matters, toward the A-10 tournament, toward the NIT or NCAA tournament, if we have more than one bid, if you're quiet around that area, then whatever you did during the regular season won't mean a thing. And I've seen that happen when I was playing D2, D3, and I've seen that happen when I was observing as a Big 12 guy. It's really weird how the scouts look at that, especially with the mid-majors. There's like no gray area, unfortunately.
The scouts' mentality is just let's see how they work under pressure, right, in that situation?
Yeah. From talking to a couple of scouts, mostly it's let me see how you are under pressure, or let me see you under pressure in a non-conference game. So like I feel as much as I want to give the A-10 credit, and now the A-10's had some successful, like historically, like eight like players that have gone to great successful careers or consistent careers. It's a lot of the scouts, although they're looking at games, like they're going to the UMass games, they're going to the big marquee games in conference, unless they already don't have you on your draft potential as it is based off just potential like Keyshawn, they're all waiting to see like, okay, let's see how George Washington does in the tournament. Neutral site. Let's see how they do. Let's see how, you know, UMass does in the tournament, because you never know who can pop off, who goes on a little win streak. I feel like that's just how they view most mid-major or like middle of the pack, like the A-10s and the Missouri Valleys and the West Coast Conference. Those mid-major conferences are like, oh, they always have talent, but let's see what they got.
Yeah, that's a great point. Kind of want to finish this off with not necessarily talking about NBA scouting, but in terms of what Daniel and I were kind of getting into with, you know, the philosophy of transferring to the Power Five, transferring out of the Power Five, kind of being, you know, a big fish in a big pond, you know, that kind of philosophy. One player I think who is probably the shining example of taking that next step, going up to the Power Five, and still being a major player on your new roster, I think you have no better place to look than Oshun Oshunye, right? I mean, he did 4 years at St. Bonaventure and then did his final year at Iowa State. And out of 33 games played, he started 29. So it can happen. It absolutely can happen. But, you know, it's really interesting to see, you know, how this philosophy continues to change. Cause I feel like some people say that, you know, I've been hearing some things that, you know, this transferring and stuff might kind of settle down a little bit depending on, you know, how people, you know, how these conferences realign, how players kind of fit into their programs, but it'll be very interesting to see. Another midweek game that I really wanted to touch on, because I feel like it's kind of shifting the focus a little bit on seeding a little bit. It's kind of maybe showing how teams settle into their roles in the conference this year, is VCU's win over Loyola Chicago. 74-67 in favor of VCU on Tuesday night. Again, Joe Bamisil, 25 points, 6 rebounds. I know a lot of people were talking about Loyola Chicago, both on the men's and women's side, being pretty strong programs this year. And VCU, obviously, reigning conference champs, reigning conference tournament champs. You know, they, I feel like the, you know, the expectations were just a big I don't know with the new head coach heading into the season with Coach Odom. What does this win or what does this loss for Loyola say about them? What is it showing that maybe this start was a little bit of a hot streak and they're going to cool down a little bit? And what does this win say about VCU? Like, should we not really close the door on them just because there's been so much changeover?
You know, Ryan Odom, I mean, Daniel knows, like, we're from here. Ryan Odom has always been regarded as a high coach, like, he'll win anywhere he'll go. So it's just that VCU for the longest time has been focused on that Havoc mentality for the last 15 years. So you got to give him time to get his players and get his system and institute that and settle. So now VCU starting to show that, hey, we're settling into where we are. We're getting that, oh, new coach jitters out, which they've never really had to go through. And since I want to believe since Anthony Grant was there, because everybody was part of the Shaka, Billy Donovan, weird family tree thing over a 15-year period. So this is the first time they've had a really brand new coach since Anthony Grant. So, and that was almost 20 years ago. So now Ryan Odom's finally getting settled in. It doesn't really say much about Loyola Chicago. It says, hey, they're figuring out they're finally settling, say, hey, we're an A-10 team based off the way Coach Valentine's finally figuring that aspect out. But so it mostly just shows that, hey, both teams are both settling into their new situations.
Yeah. And for reference, VCU in our A-10 talk power rankings these past 2 weeks, on January 8th, they were 11th in our rankings. And as of January 22nd, our latest rankings, they are 5th in the conference. So 6 spots in 2 weeks, that's a pretty significant jump. You know, this is one of those things I'm sure you ask anybody on that team, player or coach, how much that use of Havoc by Penn State, you know, which obviously is occupied by a lot of former VCU Rams, how much that kind of has fired them up to kind of retake that title. I'm sure they probably would say it's not that big of a deal. It's not something that we're really thinking about. But for the fan base, what does that mean? You know, how important is it maintaining Havoc for VCU?
From talking, I have, unfortunately, a little side note with my family. I have several VCU fans that are my family members and several. And they look at it from talking for them. They don't look at it as like, oh, I mean, it's their signature. But they understand, like, hey, I mean, Mike Roach is going to take it because that's what he coached out of from. That's what he learned out of from. It was having out of Shaka and all that. So I don't think they look at it like, ooh, Penn State trying to copy. It's just more of like, hey, Mike Roach is bringing his thing to Penn State, and Penn State hasn't really had like a strong basketball culture or other than Micah Shrewsbury or a consistent basketball culture in a while. So from talking to VCU fans I've met that live in Northern Virginia, that they're like, okay, like that's just Mike Rhodes. He's that's what he knows. I mean, that's what he knows, and he's going to translate what he knows. So I don't think there's like, I know some VCU fans are like butt hurt about it, but I mean, it's a weird thing. It's the same thing like when when Jim Larranaga left and Miami started running the scramble. That's just how they coach. This is how they coach. That's who they are. So I know some VC fans are butthurt about it, but the real basketball weird sickos that I've met that are like been following, they're like, okay, it's just how Mike coaches. That's the system that he came from.
Yeah, I will say it seems VCU fans seem to have taken it better than the Mason fans took it when Kim English took Mindset to Providence, which Mindset was always kind of like silly, kind of hokey, but like the guy bought into it. But when Kim on day one was selling Mindset t-shirts at Providence, I can tell you, at least in the Mason circles I'm in, people were pretty darn pissed about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, with that, that's different because I think I'm a Mason lifer, and I know it's a couple more inside stuff than Daniel does. But like with that, it's what was Kim, what was Paul Hewitt and Dave really doing prior to what Kim? Yeah, it seemed a little cringe and corny what Kim did, and then he brought it and took it to Providence. But like, he's the first coach that I can remember after watching George Mason my whole life. That's like, other than Jim Larranaga, like bringing his like signature and stuff, and Paul Westhead. Other than Jim Larranaga and Paul Westhead, Paul Westhead brought Run the System to Mason, but it failed because I don't think Mason was ready for it, and Mason wasn't at that level where Loyola Marymount had the athletes to do it. Kim was like the first one that actually brought something different. Like, I mean, Paul Hewitt didn't bring anything like very interesting, and that's no disrespect to Paul Hewitt if you listen to it. Sorry, Isaac, you know, sorry. But like, and Dave Paulson, same thing. Dave Paulson, I mean.
Dave Paulson was known for Mountain Dew. It's the only thing he was known for.
Like, at least Kim was like, I'm young. I'm trying to do something different. Like, the first thing I can tell you that, like, when you get new coaches into a new system, adding on to, like, that, like, I'll take it to an example with Kim. I don't know if Daniel even knows this, but first thing that Kim did was move the Final Four trophy out of the coach's office. That's where the Final Four trophy was at for since they went to 2006. It was in the coach's office. Jim Larranaga kept it in the office. Paul Hewitt kept it in the office. He put a work order in and moved the Final Four trophy to the Patriots Center on display when you enter in the bottom row. So that's right there. It already shows like Kim was trying something. And I mean, Tony's bringing his own thing too. I mean, and Tony's bringing his own thing, saying, hey, we're trying to bring it back to that. So with the new coach trying to institute stuff, it takes a little bit. It looks maybe corny and cringe at the moment, but you grow into it. So VCU's going through that same thing. Like, okay, we're no longer Havoc. What are we now? I mean, our identity is still that we're fast-paced basketball. Ryan Odom was known for that. He just doesn't do Havoc. So it's kind of it's a weird transition for them, but I think they'll get over it. As long as he doesn't leave, I think they'll be fine. Because if Ryan Odom leaves within the next 5 years, then I'm not sure. That, in my opinion, at least from a fan perspective. Basketball perspective, I think they'll be fine. But from a fan perspective, then I'll be a little upset. But
also, I feel like with Kim English taking mindset to Prov, I think another thing that kind of sets that apart from Havoc going to Penn State, right, is the context in which Kim English left. Which, you know, I really don't think the way he left was as like more of a spurn to Mason than Rhodes going to Penn State was a spurn to VCU, but the quickness of it was, I feel like, I mean, as it felt when Coach Neptune went to Villanova, right? I feel like it's a very similar context in which it happened really fast. And you know, some people were mad. Some people, some people understood. But overall, it was like, wow, that was a lot. And that was a lot happening really quick. So do you feel like that kind of had an impact on it, too? It's like, okay, you're gone that quick. And now you're taking our hashtag from us, too.
I am trying to find the right word to say it. Because with Mike Rhodes is a little interesting. Because he was taught having taken it with him. Yeah, you can take it with him. And you can just put that as like, oh, that's what we're doing. We're running the Havoc defense. I mean, but I think most VCU fans had to be realistic. If you're a realistic basketball person, you knew Mike Rhodes was going to leave at some point. He has no ties to Virginia. It's a job that can bounce you to where he's from. He's from PA. He's from that side of PA, that central PA area, that Lebanon Valley. He coached at Lebanon Valley prior as his first start. He's from PA. He's a central PA guy. So you can't look at it like as a, like a spurn. Like he went home. That's where, I mean, I would look at more Kim going to Providence as a spurn, but in my opinion, Mason couldn't keep Kim. There was just no way there was no way it was going to happen. Kim was leaving. If he wasn't leaving this past year, he was going to leave this year. Kim was just too hot of a name and too young of a coach to where it's a matter of where he was going. So with them, I don't think I look at that as like a realistic spurn, like not like a spurn. It was more like, okay, it happened quickly, but Mike was going to leave at some point. I don't think he was going to stay there the rest of his career and retire there. Just no way. Uh-uh.
Yeah. The thing with Kim though, that was always weird to me, is it never felt like he did anything. Sure, he was a good coach at Mason. Don't get me wrong. But like, it's not like he got us to like a top four appear. Like, we never got a double bye. We never made the semifinals. He didn't metrically do anything different than any other coach prior to him had done. I think the highest we finished was fifth under Kim. Same with Paulson. Like, that seemed to be the ceiling that we'd hit. And I guess that was what was surprising to me about the way Kim left, is I figured, like, yeah, Mason makes the NIT, makes, you know, the at-large bubble conversation. Sure, Kim's gone. I figured. We never even hit that. That was what was surprising to me.
Yeah. No, and when it comes to college coaching, It comes about like, all right, now with NIL and everything and transports, like, all right, who can buy in and get players to buy in quickly and try to win quickly? Providence looked at Kim's based off his win percentage of the jump, not necessarily his postseason success, because they figured Mason's young and Mason's in a weird time with the A-10. So they looked at his significant win percentage like, oh, this guy within a year increased the win percentage by like 50%. Based from 14 wins to 20 as a second year coach and with a signature win against Maryland. So they're looking, and which is a horrible way to evaluate coaches. We can all agree that here. Don't look at their regular season. Look at the overall on how they're building their program. They looked at Kim's trajectory like, all right, within 3 years, Mason would make the tournament potentially, or would be on the bubble conversation of making the tournament. So they looked at it like based off that. And if we don't get a coach like that now, we might as well get him when he's young and cheap. We can't get him in 3 years from now when, like, a real prop, don't get me wrong, Providence is Power Five in its own right. But, like, if I'm Kim English, or if you guys sitting in that coach's chair talking with your agent and talking with the AD, are you going to Providence on a smaller deal, or you're going to wait out, or you're going to take the bigger deal in, like, the ACC or the Big Ten? So let's say, like, I know Kim was in the running. Everyone's joking, saying Kim was in running for Maryland when Turgeon was fired. Obviously, he was too young for that. But like, are you gonna go Maryland or Providence? Taking Maryland. There's more money to be made, and also I'm taking Maryland. There's more money to be made if we're not talking about the extracurricular stuff. So it's weird. So yeah, Kim leaving was kind of a shock, but to me, it was just like the way the trajectory going. Like he was. I always look at it like he's going to leave at some point. He's young. Yeah, no, it was bound to happen. I mean, Rick Barnes did it too. So unfortunately, Mason's had a rough history of doing that.
Isaac, I want to keep you in this athletic director's chair for a little bit because what you were talking about, especially with the idea of, oh, hey, you know, we feel like this is a coach that could bring Mason to the tournament within 3 years. I was wondering if there was something else that, you know, the Providence athletic department would be considering. Specifically, you know, the past two seasons, you know, Cooley's last two seasons in Prov, he took them to, you know, NCAA tournaments, right? Kim English, you know, you have the young coach, you have that, you know, that building talent. And then you've also got a guy like Josh Oduro and talent that could go from Mason, experienced talent in, you know, a high quality mid-major, and then you can go over to Providence. Aside from, you know, allowing Kim English to kind of build his program in the Big East, could a potential, you know, other draw for a guy like Kim English be like, okay, look, we're going to get this guy. He's young. We can get him for a lot of years. And in the first year, we can keep fans, donors, ticket buyers happy by having a more, by continuing an experienced, talented team that could still possibly go to an NCAA tournament. Obviously, you know, they're 4-4 in conference play right now, so it's kind of tough, especially in this Big East, right? But is that kind of something that you would consider too if you were in the chair making that hire?
Yeah, you have to consider it on like the long term. You're thinking the long game. You can't think short term victories. So like that even goes to now. Like obviously, DePaul has just opened up. And obviously, we know a couple A-10 coaches are going to be in that mix. Anthony Grant should be not on the top of that list for overall coaches, but if you're looking at down at the A-10, Anthony Grant's one of them. If not the top choice out of the A-10, if you want to ask to go over there, because he understands how to recruit in the Midwest after being at Dayton for so long. So, yeah, that's what you're looking at. Like, all right, how the trajectory of where he's going to go. On where a coach is going to go, where a coach is going to get to. I think every AD has to look at that the long term. So I don't look at any hire weird unless it's like just a weird hire. Same with like UMass. UMass hired Frank Martin, which I thought was a great hire. I just think, in my opinion, UMass needs to kind of, you know, help him out with a little more resources on that point. But that's a whole nother thing. We can debate about that if they have the resources or not. But in a long term spent, you want Frank Martin because he's a culture guy. You know what he's about. He's about hard-nosed defense. He's about quick guards and, you know, tenacious offense. Great. He can build a program off of that. He can win. And this is the smallest program that the guy's ever coached in comparison to being at South Carolina, K-State, So you look at that, like, yeah, you bring in Frank Martin. Why not? You think it could work? I mean, they're winning. They look better. They look better as a team. So the trajectory is looking more positive. Same with Ryan Odom. You know what you can get. And Ryan Odom's familiar with the area. So you're looking at kind of like everything. So with Kim and Josh and bringing those players in, and I think Josh is a little, in my personal experience, I think Josh is like an anomaly. Josh is a little different. I've known Josh a little longer than most people. But I knew Josh was ready for the Big East. That's a little side note for me, but I knew Josh was more ready for the Big East based off his stats. And the stats didn't just lie, because I've had other college coaches ask me about, hey, could Josh go to the Big 12? Could Josh go to the ACC? Some other behind the doors, like trying to poach Mr. Oduru away. Heard that. So I feel like a Josh is a little different than in comparison. Like if you bring James Bishop and, you know, with like Caputo, let's say hypothetically he moves up to the ACC or a different conference. So, but yeah, no, I mean, if I'm in the AD, like you got to look at long term, what can this guy do in 3 years based off what he's doing now? So that's why you go after young coaches that seem a little questionable, like yeah, maybe. And, you know, you take chances, you take risk.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to piggyback off a few things you said, Isaac. You mentioned the DePaul coaching position open. I always like to make the joke of Mark Schmidt to DePaul after he got thrown into the UMass coaching search. That was a hilarious.
There goes Mark Schmidt.
Yeah. Shout out Chris Pyle.
I don't think it's going to happen. I feel like Mark Schmidt's very happy out at Olean. But funny enough, you mentioned Frank Martin connections up in the New England area. So he actually started out as an assistant in Northeastern before, after doing high school ball and everything. He started out as an assistant in Northeastern. His wife is a UMass alum of our track and field program. And yeah, Martin does need more resources. And I feel like the lovely Mass Collective, which is our NIL group for our men's and women's basketball team, is really trying to help with NIL deals for our men's basketball team. So sometimes you just need to hopefully run on NIL deals. And also you just need to really get more funding towards like the scholarships and everything. But I can tell you they've just done renovations, so it's replacing the courts in their practice facility. They also just named Legacy Hall in the Champion Center also after one of the longtime supporters of UMass Athletics, who was basically a manager for Jack Lehman way back into the Lehman days. So the fact that there's that UMass Athletics has done a great job of trying to keep this men's basketball team funded and to keep Martin in the head coaching position at UMass is like a great job. And honestly, while it may be the smallest school he's coached at, I feel in his future, he could definitely get UMass back into the 90s with a chance at least NCAA tournament bid. I'm not going to say this season because unfortunately we would have had to have a little bit of a better outlook if we didn't have the cross injury that kind of took us out for a few games and not making three throws, but that's beside the point. But Martin, I feel, could get us back to the 90s and has done a great job of staying connected with alumni even after the whole coaching change from McCall to him, as McCall kind of burned some bridges there. He's done a great job of rebuilding those bridges.
Wrapping that up, I want to get into some of the men's games that we've got this weekend. Right now, as we're recording this, we're a couple minutes into Friday 10, about halfway through the first half. St. Joe's is up 25-19 against St. Bonaventure in Olean. Moses Flowers, 10 points for the Bonnies. He's got, you know, 55% of their points right now, and an impressive start. Some other games that I'm looking at this weekend that are going to be really interesting. Obviously, I think two, you know, that are really important, both for kind of seeing who's going to be at the top of the A-10 for the next week or so, and also who's going to kind of be floating at the bottom for a little bit. So first up, we've got Dayton and Richmond at 6 p.m. Both 6-0 in Atlantic 10 play. That 6-0, obviously, I think, is, People are looking at Dayton as a more clear favorite in this one. It feels like, we've been talking about, right? It's Dayton number one, 2 through 15 from week to week could be pretty much anybody else. But right now, I think Richmond has kind of extended that to a 3 to 15. So is there anything, and we've talked about, I think we talked about last week how Richmond is, they've had some sneaky performances in non-conference play that show that they're a bit deeper of a team than expected. Where do you think Richmond could kind of give the Flyers some trouble here?
Well, the Spiders had a little bit of issue against Davidson this past weekend, barely eked out of there with the win in overtime. But I feel like the Spiders team could really give Dayton a run for its money. And honestly, these are the last two undefeated teams in conference, so one of these teams will be undefeated no more after this game. So the fact that it's also a nationally televised game kind of is an added perk for this one too. And the fact that Richmond has also exceeded their expectations so much from the preseason poll, with having been picked 11 in the preseason poll, and they're currently sitting in second. I feel like that's a huge thing too, is the fact that Richmond's exceeded expectations with the longest tenured coach in the Atlantic 10, Chris Mooney. And even though Mooney's had some moments of not having a really good team, I feel like this team's starting to give some glimmers of being back into the Gilliard golden days. So the fact that this Richmond team's starting to get back to some of the good old days that they were used to, and starting to creep back up towards the top of the conference, I feel like this game could literally be decided by a flip of a coin, just with how well these two teams have been competing lately.
Yeah, for me, it's Jordan King is the key. If Richmond's going to stick around in this game, he's got to have. I mean, the dude went off for 32 against GW the other night. If Richmond's going to keep this game competitive, Jordan King's going to have a night. What Richmond cannot afford to do is do what they did to GW, which is get down double digits early. Because Dayton, there was a great stat by, I think it was A10 Stats on Twitter, put out a thing today about breaking down teams by performance. If you break down the game to four quarters, Dayton is 40 points up on any other team in the conference in terms of their points in the first 10 minutes of any game. So Dayton's going to jump on you real quick. And what Richmond cannot afford to do is get down 11 in the final minutes for halftime, because GW might let you back in the game, but Dayton ain't going to do that to you. So you gotta be on your game from the jump here if Richmond's going to stay around this game.
Yeah, that's a great stat sheet that A10 Stats put out today. You should, anybody listening who is not following is, and obviously a fan of A10 basketball, otherwise why would you be listening to this podcast? But if not, welcome. If you're not following at A10 Stats on Twitter, highly recommend. Right now, they broke down the game by quarters, 10-minute increments in every game. Dayton in Q1 is they have a scoring margin of plus 56. That's unreal. Then it really drops off. In Q2, it's plus 9. Q3, it's plus 15. In Q4, it's minus 2. So, I mean, I think that really just shows that, they're just a team that they go up big early and then they kind of just coast through. And then, those last 10 minutes you're getting, they're kind of emptying in the bench there. Another thing that I thought was really interesting was VCU in Q4. They have the highest point differential at a plus 27. So that's gonna be something it's really important to look at throughout this season.
I just want to point out the other two quarter teams. So the best one in the second quarter is actually, funny enough, Richmond, with a plus 28 in that. And then the best third quarter team, funny enough, is actually my team that I represent, UMass, with being plus 26. So honestly, like, the fact that really the top four, three of the top four teams in this are teams that, well, VCU was kind of projected towards the top. While these teams haven't been towards the top recently, with Richmond and UMass, the fact that those two are actually in the top four of these is pretty funny to me. And actually, I'm pretty much proud of seeing Richmond, VCU, and UMass all being up there.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, if you have time, follow at A10 Stats, look at this chart, and figure out where your team stands. Isaac, anything about this Richmond Dayton game that you feel like people should look out for?
Daniel and I are kind of thinking about the same thing. I mean, Jordan King, don't let him go off. And Dayton's too smart of a team defensively to let him go off. So for any of the Richmond and Dayton fans that are listening, literally just Richmond better hope that, hey, because I feel like, excuse me, let me backtrack. I feel like Dayton's game plan is going to be looking like this. Let anybody else take over the game but him. From a mental standpoint, from a momentum standpoint, Jordan, don't let make somebody else score. Make somebody else have that 30 game. Make somebody else break out. Force Richmond to actually use, hell, go platoon it. Platoon it. We'll be facetious. Force Richmond to platoon, use their whole bench, use everybody. If I'm Dayton defensively, force Richmond to say, hey, we got to find every single option to try to beat them. And if I'm Richmond, if it's not broken, I mean, no need to fix it. But also, I feel like Richmond Coach Mooney's going to have, you're probably going to use a different offensive scheme just to go against Dayton's defense, because you have to with a team like Dayton that, knows how to play smart D. So,
yeah, great point. The other game I want to talk about, that kind of talking about teams that, if whoever loses this game is possibly, they really got to start worrying about, skidding further and further down the Atlantic 10. And that's UMass versus St. Louis. UMass, obviously, 3-4 after that loss to St. Joe's. St. Louis, 1-5. Obviously, the situation is not as dire for UMass as it is for St. Louis. But I know that we wanted to talk about St. Louis tonight. So that's kind of how I sandwiched this game in here. Daniel, if you want to start us off here, what is your analysis on St. Louis so far this season?
They're not good, in my professional opinion. No, I mean, like, if you look at all the numbers about St. Louis, I mean, I can only imagine the frustration that Billiken fans are facing right now. I mean, I've seen it all on Twitter. I've seen all their fans losing their minds, and justifiably so. I mean, if you break them down, Travis Ford is, what, the highest paid coach in the A-10, $2.5 million a year or something insane. They are net 240. They are 236th in the nation in offense, 298th in defense. They're 303rd in scoring margin. I mean, look, I'm not saying that, like, this St. Louis team was expected to be, like, an NCAA tournament team, a second weekend NCAA tournament team. I don't think there were any insane expectations on SLU this year. But, like, much in the way that we're kind of all like, what the hell happened to Duquesne a little bit, on a much more extreme level, because St. Louis has the recent success, what the hell happened to St. Louis here? I mean, and this game is, I think, not insignificant for both teams, and Kaylee can obviously touch on UMass far better than I can. But from the outside looking in, UMass, this is a game that 5 years ago, you looked at this and said, yeah, that's a game UMass loses, because it just feels like the type of game they would lose. And for St. Louis, this is always a game that, under recent success that they've had, you're like, yeah, that's a game they're going to win at home. And the fact that it kind of that script is completely flipped is a very weird feeling. Kaylee, I'll let you take over here, because you know more about UMass than I do, obviously.
So funny enough, I can talk on both sides of this one, as Travis is a former UMass coach. So Travis spent the 2005 to 2008 seasons with UMass. His record at UMass was 62-35. He then got hired to go to Oklahoma State and spent from 2008 to 2016 with Oklahoma State. And then he got hired at St. Louis and was at St. Louis from 2016 to present day. And well, let's just say, I think leaving UMass prematurely probably could have kicked him in the butt. But with him being the highest paid coach in the A-10, I feel like he will be good. This could be the end of the era at St. Louis, but he's also had three different types of teams at St. Louis, and he doesn't have Yuri Collins. He doesn't have Javonte Perkins. He doesn't have any of his big name players with him anymore. The only big name player that's really left with him is Gibson Jimerson. So, and he hasn't always been like the phenomenal player that he needs. So I feel like right now the St. Louis team is a lot more questionable, especially as Ford let Press sit for over 30 minutes after the Davidson loss, which they had a lead in going into the second half. So this St. Louis team is kind of a little bit all over the place with wins and losses. Their only win actually coming against, funny enough, the team UMass lost to on Tuesday, St. Joe. So UMass better not lose this one because honestly, I don't know what Frank Martin will be like after it if they lose, especially since that game is 8 o'clock Eastern time. But UMass is back to full strength, so this shouldn't be a game I'm like overly concerned about for the Minutemen. The only thing I could be concerned about is if Matt Cross is going to take another injury blow.
Put some bubble wrap on his tooth or something. What the hell was up with that?
No, he just needs bubble wrap, period. Although he is tough as a rattlesnake, as Martin has put him, considering he tweaked his other ankle against St. Joe's, his right ankle after spraining his left ankle against LaSalle. The fact that it's just gotten to this point, Matt Cross needs like a bodyguard out there with him or something. I don't know. But Cross can honestly take any blow. He was very antsy about playing and everything, but honestly, this UMass team really needed Matt Cross. The fact that Matt Cross is back and this will be a second game back. Hopefully he'll be back in the starting lineup for this one, but honestly, UMass has been missing that big rebounding piece with Cross not being available for 3 games. So Cross being back with Cohen up and going, and if Curry can cook, well, you got the Triple C factory running in St. Louis, but for UMass, not for St. Louis.
If I could, give some credit to Travis Ford, I understand that there's a consensus that, I think a lot of people might be ready to move on. But if I can give him some credit, 2019 Atlantic 10 champs, Atlantic 10 tournament champs, right? For the past 5 seasons, 10 win seasons in conference play. That one season that was not was the COVID year where they had to cancel a lot of games, and in that time they finished 14-7, and at one point they were ranked as high as 22. For a lot of people, for that stretch of time, that is a very solid, very impressive run for any coach in any conference, right? But even so, the crux of that is that when you raise the standard like that, people want you to continue to raise it. They want you to continue to raise that bar. And if you can't get to that next level, which, i.e., more consistent A10 tournament, A10 tournament championships, more consistent NCAA tournament appearances, it gets tough. So my question to all of you is, how long will you allow a coach to kind of ride on the coattails of previous impressive seasons before, a couple, missteps force you to, think maybe there should be a new answer.
When it comes to that, with Travis Ford, I want to give him more of the benefit of the doubt for what he's built over with his with at his version of St. Louis for his teams. But I mean, unfortunately, there's not a lot of room for error for him right now. This is a must-win game for him. I feel like every game in conference is a must-win game for him and the Duquesne coach. And Duquesne, and so especially for Travis Ford, because he set such a high bar and such a high standard of like, hey, we are the A10. We are the A10, and that essentially. So with that, and then plus you got to look at who potentially could be on the market that could even take it to that could meet those expectations that St. Louis wants, and that that could keep him around a little longer. I mean, I want to say that he gets the benefit of the doubt for what he's built, but also I don't because of who could be potentially on the market. What young up and coming coach could be potentially there? I mean, because even to the counterpart, Frank Martin was in that same situation in South Carolina State. I mean, not South Carolina State, excuse me, South Carolina. And I can attest to you from a personal opinion, Frank shouldn't have. I didn't want Frank fired. I thought Frank did the impossible was take a pure football school to the Final Four and actually recruited consistently to where and actually like tapped into like the South Carolina recruiting base, which is very, very hard to do consistently. So shout out to Frank did an excellent job at South Carolina. It just, you know, it ran its course. Naturally ran its course. I feel like if Frank gave him the opportunity, I don't think he would have like ran and like ran away from any challenge, but Frank probably would have pulled a Shaka Smart and went to a slightly smaller school before they could fire him too. Despite, you know, finishing 500 or finishing bad. So I feel like with Travis Ford, like, you know, I don't think there's a lot of room for error right now. I think he's on a short leash, sadly, because of potentially of who could they get, you know, what could look better. But yeah, I want to give him that leash, but, you know, it's a business.
Right. And I don't disagree with you at all, Isaac, but another factor too I've seen with coaches getting let go is how, like, what has their record been in the past few years? So kind of using my UMass teams as an example. They fired Kellogg after having two or three losing seasons. They fired McCall after having two. As a UMass fan, the two darkest years in this program's history that I've been alive for, since Calipari was there, since the Steve Lapis times. The fact that if you just look at his record at St. Louis alone, he's like, his overall record at St. Louis is he's 141 and 100. This season he's 8-11. Last season he was 21-12. The season prior was 23-12. So I don't want to necessarily say it could be over yet, but if there is a better coach in the market, like a younger coach that could possibly take in on this program, he could be gone. But also to the fact of he's kind of got his back up against the wall of not having a team that is like, that we've seen in the past, like, again, having a Yuri Collins, a Fred Thatch Jr., or even Javonte Perkins, all of which I mentioned. Though, like, not having big key players like that kind of sort of is a little rougher for any team. But it isn't really a full excuse because, like, Travis has gone through several different, like, eras within the St. Louis, like, tenure. So he's only had one other losing season while at St. Louis, and now his first season there. So you can kind of give him a little bit of slack after trying to rebuild the program up. And, well, I don't want to see him gone. Saturday's game could be a deciding factor for him against UMass, as well as really what's left into the season. And, like, he held it close against Dayton, only lost by 5 to Dayton on national television. It's just, how can he really pull out the rest of the season? If you remember Duquesne a few years back, Duquesne only won one conference game in the entirety of conference play, and Dambrot stayed. And then Dambrot flipped the program around completely and had a really great season last year. I don't want to say this is what we're seeing in St. Louis right now, but it's kind of giving me a little bit of glimmers. And the funny enough thing is, the one game that Duquesne won was actually against UMass in that conference play run. But I don't want to say it's the end of an era for Travis at St. Louis, but this very well could be, depending on how the final games of conference play, like, really go out.
Yeah, so that's going to be a huge game. We've got four more games on Saturday as well. Anything specific that is popping out to you that you feel like fans should be watching here?
Rhodey Mason, honestly. I feel like that is, we mentioned it earlier. Both teams have been very streaky throughout conference play. I like, just knowing from kind of watching Rhodey from afar, but Mason's also had a streaky season. But I think Daniel and Isaac can kind of talk a little bit more about this Mason Rhodey game than I can, as they are both Mason correspondents. So I feel like that's the other big game I would be watching this weekend on the men's side.
Hey, Daniel, it's homecoming.
It is homecoming.
Homecoming. So, I mean, when you and me both know, homecoming weekend's a very special weekend here in Fairfax. Historically, it's a big snow day or big games. And historically, it's like some of the bigger games and some of the most memorable moments. So I'm looking forward to it. I hope I get to watch most of it. I have some stuff going on, but it's going to see how can Mason start a win streak again. That's what I'm looking for, is can Mason stay consistent? They've been shooting. They shot a lot better last weekend. But it's still not to where to it's still not to a part where I want to see them shoot. As far as especially with a really streaky roadie team. But that's where I mostly just kind of that's my biggest concern for Mason is like, all right, you guys finally can show you guys should shoot better. Can you guys maintain it or even improve on it?
Yeah, I want to expand a little bit on your homecoming point because I think I want to give fans a little bit of context here. I know we talked about this on the podcast a couple years ago, but for those not familiar, homecoming at Mason is held in January, February every single year. We're not a football school. We don't have football. So we always do it in the spring. I say spring in big air quotes because it can be very miserable out there most years. But you have like a real tailgate season that goes on. Every single year, this is Mason's biggest crowd of the season. Unless a Power Five comes in, which has not been, it's like 10 years since a Power Five played at Mason for the men. And more to the point, I'm really curious how Tony Skin's going to treat his first homecoming back at Mason, because I know he understands probably better than any of the coaches we've had the last several years, last several coaches, what homecoming means to the Mason community. And so I'm curious what Tony's going to bring in his first game. It's I know this game was, when it was scheduled, probably wasn't the sexiest because Rhodey was not expected to have really many expectations this year. And since they now have kind of established themselves as probably some middle of the pack-ish team Rhodey has, you know, Mason was at, for a brief glimmer of time, top of the conference conversation. I think that's kind of faded back to, you know, we're hoping to just stay out of the pillow fight. You know, double bye is probably out of the realm of possibility. But, you know, to get yourself in a better position come March, which is ultimately what this is about for Tony. This is year one. It's all about building for the future. And you want to see Mason continue to take those steps. This is a big game for Mason to make sure they're riding the ship. You never want to have a skid go too far. You know, they got the big win against Bonna. Then this is the next step. You know, you got to take her. This is a roadie team that is prime for, you know, this is exactly the type of game that Mason wants right now, I think, with where they're at. And this is the game that Mason needs to take from roadie.
Yeah, no, I mean, to piggyback on that, Mason, you're right. This is Tony's first homecoming and first homecoming as a coach for the staff. And I can tell you right now, we're going to see a lot of, if for those who are going to the game, you're going to see a lot of players that, you know, a lot of the alumni go there. The final four, a good chunk of the Final Four team that is local will be there, or that is within a local drive that will be there. Hey, you know, you never know. It's homecoming is always emotional for a lot of the Mason guys. I know the last few years it hasn't been, you know, due to the game schedule or, you know, what's going on. I mean, but this is a bigger game. I think this is a game that also the NCAA committee looks at as well. I feel like not a lot of people think about that. You know, they look at certain games, not only just from the net rankings and Kevon, but they look at this game also as an emotional point for Mason. Like, all right, did Mason win their homecoming game? And also they're in a, this is a good turnaround too, right? Going into that back end of the conference play. And, you know, Rhode Island also looks at this too, like, hey, let's spoil their homecoming. A lot of other teams have done it in the past. You know,
they didn't win a single one. My 4 years at Mason, we never won homecoming.
That's rough. Exactly. It's rough. And like, and prior to going into the A-10, Mason homecoming games were on national television. Like, I mean, like during the late half of the CAA, because it's close to the bracket busters. So Tony was playing on like ESPN, like prime time, 2 o'clock, like during the Larrañaga days and like maybe a little bit of the earlier of the Hewitt days before, after Larrañaga left. But, you know, and Mason hasn't, they want this win. They want to get back that homecoming winning tradition where the fans are going a little crazy. It's right, you know, end of January, early February. You know, so hopefully we goes there. So I know Rhode Island's looking at it like, hey, let's get this as a emotional win for us as well to try to, you know, build some more consistency as well. So big game for both teams.
I got to say, I mean, I was already going to watch this game, but all that info that you just brought to us right now has, I am enthralled in this. I mean, just for so many reasons, right? Just Mason's homecoming culture, right? A homecoming basketball game is really cool, first of all.
A lot of men do it.
Yeah, it's unique. It's a challenging, you know, you say, you know, you joked about how Mason's lost a lot of homecoming games, but it's especially challenging to schedule your homecoming game in conference play, right? Because, I mean, when it comes to a lot of sports, like, for example, like my high school, we didn't have football, but our homecoming game was a soccer game, right? And it was, you know, I believe it was, they tried to do it, like, out of league. So, you know, you want to schedule a team that you could probably beat at home. So in football and basketball, you do it in the non-conference because you have so much more control over that. So it's kind of like, I kind of respect Mason for doing it during, you know, a potentially important game, not just a game where, oh, you know, we'll go in, we'll beat them by 25 and then everyone will have a good time. And Isaac, you bring up a great point in, you know, how much, you know, winning a big game like this is important for the committee, right? You know, not that a team should, not that really like a crowd should be the factor in, you know, getting a basketball team into a tournament. But at the end of the day, you know, another thing that the NCAA committee is doing is they're selling TV time. Right. So it's like, if you can get a good, if they can see that there's a good crowd and there's a good team behind, like in front of it, then yeah, that could help their chances a little bit. I just want to ask, like, what other things do you do at a wintertime homecoming? I know, Daniel, you mentioned tailgating, but you know, what else is going on around campus at this time?
Mason got you drink going on, right? Yeah.
You drink? No, I mean, usually kicks off with a pep rally. Of some variety. It's not usually big. It's not like an Eagle Bank or anything. It's usually just some, you know, student building on campus. There's usually like a featured like speaker or something, like a comedy special kind of situation that they'll bring in somebody. And then the tailgates were the focal point. They get all the frats, because Mason doesn't have any frats or anything on campus. It all is off campus, but it's officially sponsored, so it's kind of weird. But all the frats host like their own tailgate thing, like in the parking lot outside EBA. A bunch of the donors will do it. The Bio George guys, I know they go hard every year. They're a great time there. They great food. There's tons of DJs. All the music is like mixing, and it's a great time. I mean, there's literally hundreds of people. I mean, if not thousands. I mean, it is an impressive turnout for what is often a 40-degree rainy day. I mean, it is impressive. It's something, if you've never done it before, I know everyone's got like an A-10 bucket list. Mason homecoming should be on your A-10 bucket list. Like, it's, you know, we're not Fog Allen over here. We're not Cameron Indoor, but it's a good time.
Yeah, no, Mason homecoming is always a good time because you never know. And the whole community comes out. I mean, I know the whole community comes out. It's a big tailgate. People go to the game and, you know, have a good time. I know a lot of the former players will come back. I know last year I saw AJ Wilson in the stands, and he's a good childhood friend of mine. So we were talking, he's wearing his old Mason jersey, and a lot of the former players go back. And I mean, and Mason's not even the only school. I don't know if VCU still does it. I know VCU used to have a winter homecoming. If they still do, I haven't followed their schedule when it is. And I know my previous alma mater did it, but Ryder is in the Metro Atlantic, very much smaller scale in comparison to what Mason has their winter homecoming to actually tailgate and stuff. So it's a fun time. I've always had fun. And I think like some of the most memorable homecoming games are when, you know, unfortunately is when they were in the CAA, when those games, and it was because usually I remember from my, someone can correct me in the comments or send an email. You know, back then the reason why the Mason homecoming games were so fun is because they're in the bracket. They're sometimes scheduled as bracket during the bracket busters day. So you didn't know who they were playing. So I remember like one time Wichita State came in, like Wichita State, Mark Turgeon's Wichita State, like when there was just starting to get back really good. So like Mark, like Wichita State would be coming, or Creighton would be coming into the building. So like, you never know at one point, like homecoming games, you'd be like, you don't know who we're going to play. It could be number 25 in the AP on the AP poll. And we're on ESPN, sweet. Or back, or you know, after the bracket buster deals phased out, you know, VCU. It's a rivalry game. it's a rivalry game. VCU or somebody more like, okay, let's try, definitely get all the fans out, you know, and let's do something interesting. So homecoming games like that, yeah. Go, if you get a chance, come down to DC for it. It's fun. They're really fun.
Can UMass swap to doing winter homecomings, please?
Yeah, your football scene admittedly kind of doesn't look super fun.
Our football, whenever we have homecoming up here, it's always with an FCS team, and 90% of the time I don't even know if we're gonna beat the FCS team, which is sad. So that's why I'm saying, can we get a winter homecoming and base it around hockey and basketball, please? Hockey's doing better than anything. Come on.
And this is a thing I do like that Mason does do, is they never promote the women's game as well, anywhere close to as well as they promote the men's game, but they do officially sponsor both the men's and women's home game for homecoming weekend. So, and we'll talk about this, I know, in a minute here, because it probably is the biggest game of the weekend on the women's side.
Yes.
But Mason women are hosting their own homecoming game on Sunday.
Yep.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a sec, but I just wanted to finish off the men's slate. So that game, Rhodey Mason, that's the lone 4 o'clock game on Saturday. So if you're sitting down on the couch and you're watching college basketball all day, and you've got an A-10 focus, I mean, there's no reason not to watch that game. Some other games on the slate that could be interesting: Fordham heading over to Duquesne. Fordham is 3-0 in A-10 play on the road, and 0-3 at home in A-10 play. So interesting start to the season. We'll see if Fordham can continue that momentum in Pittsburgh. That game tips off at 12:30. Dayton-Richmond, as we mentioned, that tips off in Richmond at 6, along with LaSalle, George Washington in Foggy Bottom. And then at 8, we've got UMass and St. Louis at Shea Fitz Arena. And then at the same time, we've got VCU taking on Davidson in North Carolina. Let's get into that women's slate. And you mentioned that Mason game. That is going to be a huge game for Mason. Obviously, they are tied for third in the Atlantic 10, you know, fourth. They're sitting in fourth with the tiebreaker, blah, 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 blah. But they are playing VCU for sole possession of third place, potentially. Well, actually, they probably, whoever wins this game is going to be tied for.
Yeah, it's second. Weird because we have an odd number of teams, so we're not going to have an even number of games played for a hot second, because both St. Joe's and Richmond also still play this weekend. So Mason, it's weird, but effectively, it's for a share of first place, essentially.
Oh yeah, wow.
Because so Mason and VCU, for those to set the stage, Mason and VCU are both tied at 6-1. Richmond and St. Joe's are tied at 7-1. Effectively a four-way tie for first place. You know, one game less, whatever. This is a substantially important game for Mason. I don't want to like overstate the importance of this game, because with each game of this season for Mason, and folks who've listened to this podcast throughout the season have heard me gush and gush and gush about how much I love this Mason women's team. And so for me myself, I'm just trying to take everything one game at a time. But if you're looking at George Mason as a legitimate NCAA tournament contender, which is, according to ESPN's Charlie Cream, they are. They're in the next four out right now. They are net number 48, which is the best in the Atlantic 10 by, I believe, 8 spots. This is a quad 2 game for Mason. VCU is net, I think they're 73, somewhere right in there.
74,
they're right on, they're what?
74, I believe.
74, okay. So they're right on the edge of quad 2 at home, quad 3. But Mason needs this game to stay a quad 2, just like they need Davidson to stay a quad 2 to continue to boost their resume. But when you have a game like this at home, I mean, Mason has a fortunate schedule with the way that it shakes out for them. Sure, they're not going to get the quad opportunities because they're playing all the best teams at home. But when you have the best teams at home, you got to win these games. Mason's 15-3, 6-1 in the A-10. They're rolling right now. The last two games have been not as impressive. They had to be winning games by 30. They kind of dialed it back a little bit. They're winning games by 15 points. You know, it's a little come back to earth, but they were both on the road. VCU comes in boasting the number one defense in the entire country, which is a substantial challenge for Mason. Mason faced the 37th best defense in the country on Wednesday at GW. I know we have a couple. I think Davidson is also in the top 50, I believe. This is a different beast. Everyone knows that. But Mason has the horses to run with VCU. Mason has one of the top 5 benches in the entire country in terms of offensive output. VCU has all the horses too. VCU, I think they're 16-3, I think is the record. They're right there too. They're a little behind the net, so they're not quite in the at-large conversation. But this is a quad 1 game for VCU. So you want to talk about catapulting yourself, because not even just the NCAA tournament, but the WBIT, which is the brand new tournament, which is the second tier tournament, replacing, kind of knocking the WNIT down a tier. But that's still, you're looking at basically getting yourself to a postseason tournament here for VCU. This is a game that can get you in that conversation. The importance of this game cannot be overstated. I'll let other people speak because I'm rambling, but I'm very excited for this game.
In all the good points, because I'll be honest, had Mason beat Maryland, I think they wouldn't have to. I wouldn't have if had Mason beat Maryland. In my opinion, I think Mason wouldn't be too anxious at coming into this game.
And they led that game by 10 in the second half. Like they had it.
Mason showed throughout the country. Although we should be in the conversation, but their non-conference play, unfortunately, out of one of the three losses, didn't help. I wish you wish Mason was going in this game, with only two losses. But looking at it, you're going against the number one team, number one defense, and then also the committee's going to look at all right, you're at home, you better win this game at home, and then also significant homecoming week as well. It's significant. You got a big atmosphere going on. It's that's also significant too with this Mason team because they're entering uncharted territory that they have not seen in a while after they win this game. If in Duplan they win this game, they're entering uncharted territory. Now it's like, oh, now we can't lose anything. Because any other losses after that is going to be a bad loss.
You both...
And for context, too, George Mason and women have never made the NCAA tournament before.
Never. In the 50 years of their program, they've never made the tournament.
Sorry, Kaylee, go ahead.
Honestly, you guys both nailed this pretty straightforward. Kind of from the outsider looking in and actually just having watched Mason play in person recently, actually. Mason kind of gave me a little bit of a jump scare when UMass had a lead over them. Also gave a great friend of Daniel and I, Natalie Heverin, a little bit of a jump scare, too. We love Natalie here on the women's side. But the fact that Mason was able to turn around very quick and was able to recover after a slow start in that first quarter, Mason definitely shows that they could be up for an at-large bid. It's just Mason needs to avoid the friendly fire of conference play, which wreaks havoc on itself and chaos. Two things I will keep repeating until the day I die on this podcast. But this Mason VCU game really is also a huge determining factor for our lovely A-10 Talk women's basketball power rankings, with Richmond having that very, very surprising loss, I want to say, to Duquesne, kind of throws a little bit of a wrench into probably people's voting for this week. So, honestly, the fact that this is literally what's going to be the deciding factor for who's number one, whether it's Mason or VCU. Honestly, this game is really the best game to be watching on the women's side this week, especially with it being matching up perfectly as the men don't really have much going on Sunday. Having this game be on Sunday, and is it nationally televised or am I just thinking incorrectly? Not nationally televised.
It's ESPN Plus. Okay.
Nationally streamed. Not nationally televised, unfortunately. I was hoping it would have been nationally televised since these are two powerhouse teams, but But
there is one nationally televised game this weekend on the women's side, and that is St. Bonaventure at Dayton on Sunday at 12. That's going to be on CBS Sports Network. St. Bonaventure 1-7 in A-10 play, Dayton 2-6. Not the most important game in the conference right now to put on national TV, but regardless, if you're just someone who's flipping around all the national games, what could entice you to watch this one?
Honestly, what I'm gonna say is you could watch Tamika Williams-Jeter continue to be ramping up this Flyers program, especially after very fiery exit on Wednesday afternoon against VCU. Coach Williams-Jeter got ejected from the game due to making contact with a ref midway through the third quarter. It was her first ever ejection as a coach. But this program has gone leaps and bounds much better from where they were last year. I feel like this program, she can keep rebuilding this. This is still a rebuild. But I could see in the near future having this Dayton team be trending back up towards the top. And that's the same case with our St. Bonaventure team as well, with bringing back Jim Crowley, who basically had the highest point in the St. Bonaventure women's basketball history, took them into the NCAA tournament, I believe the Sweet 16. So the fact that Jim Crowley's coming back and like after spending 7 years with Providence, I feel like it's the right time to kind of see both of these programs where they're at rebuilding wise. And well, honestly, it goes to show you that, well, while teams that were really good in the past decade or so, yeah, it does take time to like, and they lost coaches from it. It does take time to rebuild those programs back up. And honestly, I feel like even though this is a nationally televised game of a pillow fighter, essentially, these two teams could really come out and surprise you. Granted, I haven't watched much of Bonaventure, but from what I've seen of Dayton, Dayton could really come out and surprise you at any point. I mean, they held it close with VCU for a good point of that game. So honestly, this game is probably one of the better games we've had on national television for a pillow fight-wise, not discounting our St. Joe's roadie game that we did have on national TV last week. But honestly, this game is probably one of the better ones we've seen.
If I could draw your attention to what I consider probably the second best game of the weekend on the women's side, it's a Saturday game, so you're going to have to squeeze into a very packed Saturday slate of games. St. Joe's Davidson. St. Joe's right now is one of the other teams that is in the bubble conversation. They're in the first four out. They're behind Mason and Nett by 8 points, I believe, but they're right there. They have a better resume probably overall than Mason, which is probably giving them a slight boost right now. This is a quad one game for both teams. Davidson was the probably best team in the non-conference for both Davidson was probably the best non-conference performer for the Atlantic 10 this year for the women. Had two ACC wins, if not, and they were close to a third. Have dealt with some injuries. Ellie Sutphin's back out again. It seems like she was seen in a boot. I know Susie Rose Deegan is done for the year. She got hurt at Mason. Still missing a couple other pieces. But this is a Davidson team that can still contend for a double bye. They've fallen a couple games in a row. I think they're 3-3 right now. But they're still 73 in the net. So this is a game that, you know, if Davidson is going to make a case for themselves to kind of get back on the right track, this is an important game for Davidson. On the other hand, you have St. Joe's, who is the best team in the entire country on the road. They're 10-0 on the road. It's the most wins without a loss of any team in the country right now. These Hawks just don't lose on the road. And it's a quad one game for St. Joe's, who is already right on the bubble. And this is a game that can move the needle for them.
Funny enough, since you mentioned that, this is actually not a road game for St. Joe's. This is actually a home game for them in Hagen Arena. And they've
Never mind.
sorry for putting a little pin in your bubble. But honestly, I liked how you said that St. Joe's has had tremendous success on the road. This is granted, this is a home game, but they've also had tremendous success at home, with the exception of the Richmond loss and the kind of sort of blowout loss to Utah, which are their only two losses on the season. So honestly, with those being the only two losses on the season right now, this team does have a chance of really being bubbleville to the NCAA tournament and to big league women's side, question mark? We don't know yet.
And it's worth noting that Richmond's still right there too. I mean, Richmond, we don't really know where they stand because they're listed in all the bracketology as the automatic qualifier. But they have the three teams that we've talked about between Mason, St. Joe's, and Richmond. Richmond by far has the best resume. They're 3-1 against quad two. They're 0-1 against quad one. I'm looking at the wrong category here. They have three quad one wins. They're 3-3 against quad one. They're 3-0 against quad two. They're net 56. They're 17-4, 7-1. So for their quad one wins, they beat Drake on a neutral on the road. Sorry, they beat Villanova. They beat St. Joe's on the road, and then they beat Davidson on the road. So they have three quad one. I can't do math, but they have. They have probably the strongest resume of any of the three we've talked about. And it was a quad three loss they took to Duquesne on Wednesday, but it was a loss that they had a buffer for. That buffer is probably a little bit gone now. And St. Louis is a team that they really can't afford to lose to right now. So keep an eye on this Richmond team, see how they bounce back after taking that loss to Duquesne midweek as well.
And you also mentioned Duquesne. I want to highlight this game, actually. Loyola Chicago versus Duquesne. Both teams on the women's side. Duquesne didn't have the best non-conference play, but Duquesne has definitely bounced back significantly in conference play. With losses, I forgot who one of the losses was, but I know one of them was Mason. But Duquesne is probably going to be Richmond's kryptonite for this season. If Richmond does lose another game this season, Richmond does play Duquesne again on February 28th. So the second to last real slate of games before the conference tournament. So honestly, the fact of that happening again is we could see Richmond slide another game, but it also depends on where Duquesne is really sitting a month from now. And well, that's a month away from this, but Loyola Chicago has been doing really good as of late. We wanted to make sure we highlighted both Loyola Chicago teams on both sides tonight. And honestly, this women's team has also taken tremendous steps forward as Dayton has from last season. So Coach Guth is building a great program out in Chicago. And well, the Rambles just keep rambling their way through conference play, especially after they rambled over, unfortunately, Sam's team, the Florida Rams. Yes, that was a lot of ramming, but you got to go with the Rambles and the rambling. We can't forget about the other Rams. Since we mentioned the VCU Rams, the Fordham Rams, and now the Loyola Chicago Ramblers, I got to also mention the Rhodey Rams. So Rhodey, while this game isn't essentially like a top-tier game, UMass versus URI, probably one of the biggest rivalries that UMass does have still in this conference. Basically, I like to call it the New England rivalry game in the conference. But Rhodey also does have an LD top back after being out for several games. So Rhodey does have one of their key pieces back, but Tenny Magasa has picked up significantly for when AD has been out. So honestly, the fact that really this Rhodey team has hit a few bumps in the road with it either being they just can't find consistent shots or even just trying to like win games consistently. They've already lost more games than they lost last season. But honestly, like, this Rhodey team's a lot different from last year's team. They don't have Emma Squires, who is an interconference transfer from Richmond. So honestly, there's some missing pieces on both sides of this, especially for UMass, because they don't have really any big scorers other than Steph Kalaja and Kristen Williams. Not trying to bash my minute woman, but a 30-point loss to Davidson on Wednesday. Most points they scored in a total quarter of a game was 18 points in the second quarter. The other three quarters, they scored a total of 8 points each of those quarters, which are some of the lowest scoring quarters I've seen out of them this season. But honestly, the Rams are doing pretty well. The Rams and the Ramblers are doing very well this year in conference play. And well, we got to just let them keep rambling on and ramming their way through the conference tournament standings.
Keep yourself from descending into pun madness. I think we're gonna cap it off here. And that was another great, you know, recap of what we've seen this past week and what we've got coming up in just a fantastic men's and women's basketball slate. So I think that's gonna do it for this week of the A10 Talk podcast. Make sure you keep following us at A10 Talk on, you know, all of our socials. Make sure you keep checking out a10talk.com. And we shouted out A10 Stats tonight, so give them a follow too on Twitter at A10 Stats. But until then, for Kelly Godek, Daniel Frank, and Isaac Harris, I'm Sam Basil. This has been the A10 Talk podcast. We'll see you guys next time.